Expert in guerrilla warfare. His study of quote-unquote societal collapse led him to invent this bow and arrow in which you can also have store your water purification tablets. It has a lot of other functions. We're not quite sure what he's doing at the Department of Treasury, but there's some interesting characters.
The high school student in New Hampshire?
Many former Trump campaign staffers. This one gentleman, his name is Danny Tiso, has been hired at the Department of Labor. Seems to have graduated from high school just in 2015, then went to work for the Trump campaign. You know, to be fair, it's not unusual for administrations to bring in people who worked for the campaign, but the Trump administration has brought in many more of these people for these early hires.
Well, I'm going to ask you to stay during this snowpocalypse, and we'll do a post-show and post online at democracynow.org, and we're just going to go through some of the names of the people who have been chosen, because they don't have to be approved by Congress. Justin Elliott, reporter at ProPublica, will link to your pieces. Meet the hundreds of officials Trump has quietly installed across the government. That does it for the program. We have an amazing group that came in on this snowy day. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura. Thanks so much to Julie Crosby and Paul Huckabee. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Steve Early Lecture, taking place Sunday, March 19th at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Steve Early, author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, will speak and discuss his book regarding the transformation of Richmond, California, from a fossil fuel-dominated town to one of the most progressive cities on the West Coast. Again, that's Steve Early, Sunday, March 19th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1121 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
The time is now 5:01 p.m. That means it's your evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a proposed Oregon State bill would reduce mortgage interest reductions for the wealthy.
South Dakota legalizes religious-based discrimination.
And local anarchists are filling potholes. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 14th, 2017. I'm Joe Lino.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. A group calling itself Portland Anarchist Road Care posted on Facebook that they have begun fixing potholes in local neighborhoods. The group describes its mission by saying, quote, "Because we believe in building community solutions to the issues we face outside of the state. Because society portrays anarchists as only breaking windows and blocking roads. Because when faced with anarchism as a political theory, statists often ask, but who will fix the roads? Because the city of Portland refuses to adequately repair roads in a timely manner," unquote. Their Facebook page shows members of the group repairing potholes in Southeast Portland and encourages others to create their own repair crews. This comes after significant road damage from this winter's storms. The city responded to the storm damage with a February Portland Bureau of Transportation patch-a-thon, which temporarily increased the number of crews available to patch about 450 potholes in 2 days. PBOT typically receives between 10 and 20 reports of potholes each day. Residents can make their own report to the city by calling the maintenance hotline at 503-823-1700.
Today, the Portland Water Bureau announced that starting tomorrow, Portland residents will once again be getting their water from the Bull Run watershed. Water had been coming from groundwater wells after tests between early January and early March detected the parasite Cryptosporidium. The wells have served Portland water consumers for about a month. While water officials expect to find isolated instances of the parasite in the future, they say the public health risk remains low. Unlike most cities, Portland does not treat its water for Cryptosporidium. It received an exemption to chemical treatment against the parasite in 2012 after zero particles were detected between 2002 and 2012. Increased testing will continue through next January, however. While health officials say the risk remains low, they urge Portlanders with compromised immune systems to consult their physicians.
Oregon's biggest housing subsidy is the deduction of mortgage interest in calculating state income. While the deduction has a huge impact on the housing market, there's a coalition of housing organizations who say that it's not fair for moderate to lower income homeowners. They claim that the state's top 20% of income earners get more than 60% of the state subsidy in terms of dollars. Key reporter Tom Flynn interviewed Juan Carlos Ordonez, communication director with the Oregon Center for Public Policy, or OCPP. The OCPP is joining the Oregon Opportunity Network, a statewide coalition of affordable housing and low-income services, and spearheading legislation for the 2017 legislative session in Salem.
Can you tell me, what is the coalition of housing and public interest groups that's come together to work for changes in tax policy related to housing?
Yeah, it's a very broad statewide coalition made up of well, for one, led by the Oregon Center for Public Policy and the Oregon Opportunity Network. And there are also many housing advocacy groups, members of the faith community. Some labor groups have also participated. Just a wide range, array of organizations representing many corners of our state.
We understand that the coalition is proposing some changes in state tax law with respect to the mortgage interest deduction. Can you explain what those changes are?
Sure. It's important to recognize that the Oregon mortgage interest deduction is the state's biggest housing subsidy. And the problem is that it is subsidizing people, for the most part, it is subsidizing people who do not need help owning a home. Most of the subsidy is going to the wealthiest Oregonians. And that is why it also fails to promote homeownership, because those who are getting the help are those who would buy a home anyway. And yet we are in the midst of a very severe statewide housing crisis. So it is just plain common sense and decency that the housing subsidy should go to those who need the help. And that is what our bill does. It's a very common sense reform of this deduction, which would basically limit eliminate the benefits going to those at the very top of the income scale. And eliminate, for example, also the ability to deduct interest on a vacation home. So we think that it's and it would take then the tax savings, the tax revenue, and invest that in programs that actually promote home ownership for low and moderate income folks, as well as increase the supply of rental units, and also help address the state's very severe homelessness problem.
Now, the Realtors Association has a different approach, proposed House Bill 2996. How does their approach contrast with that of the OCPP coalition?
Well, their approach is to exacerbate the problem. Their proposed bill would grant even more tax subsidies to those at the top of the income scale. It would make it would make matters worse. What it would do is that it would allow the wealthy to basically create tax shelters to shield income from taxation, and then be able to, with that money, buy their kids or relatives, assist them with a down payment. And again, these are folks who do not need help from the state in order to be able to buy a home. They would just be giving them a tax break for something that they will already do. So the Realtors Association is taking a diametrically opposed view. In their view, it is the wealthy who need the help.
Would the changes you're proposing actually improve housing availability here in Portland?
It would. A very significant amount of money would go to both increase the supply, both of rental units, but also starter homes. So it would actually potentially be stimulative of the housing, of the construction industry as well, and that the money would be stay in housing and would be directed to building more units.
What would be the effect on the second home industry, on the coast and tourism and recreational homes?
We don't think it would have any impact at all, because for a couple reasons. For one, to the extent that people own a second home for purposes of renting it out. In other words, they buy a property but rent it. That income, that the interest payments on that home can be deducted as a business expense. So no matter what the owner's income or interest amount would be, they would still be able to deduct it as a business expense. And secondly, if it's a purely vacation home, a unit that is purely a vacation home is owned by someone of very significant means. And the fact that they won't qualify for a very small subsidy from the state certainly won't deter them from buying a vacation home on the coast. These are people of means who would buy a purely vacation home.
Is there a bill before the legislature that will be voted on this year that proposes this change?
There is a bill before the legislature. It's House Bill 2006. It is currently with the House Committee on Housing and Human Services. We had our first hearing last week, and there was a great deal of great many people showed up to testify in support of the bill.
Last question, Juan Carlos. There are few tax breaks that are more sacred to the housing industry than the mortgage interest deduction. How do you propose to get legislators to support the changes that you're proposing?
I think a lot of people misunderstand the mortgage interest deduction and don't realize that it is by and large a subsidy for those well off. So part of it is just helping folks understand what it really is. And second, the proposal that we have put forward, House Bill 2006, is a very common sense reform that will leave the vast majority of homeowners unaffected. They will be able to continue to deduct interest in the same amount as they have been. It really is a targeted reform aimed at eliminating the subsidy for those at the very top of the income scale, those who do not need help from taxpayers in terms of affording a home. So we think that it is a very common sense reform and much needed in the face of the very severe housing crisis that we have in our state.
Juan Carlos, thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Juan Carlos Ordonez, the Communications Director at the Oregon Center for Public Policy. This has been Tom Flynn with KBOO News.
U.S. Representative Joe Barton from Texas told a man who confronted him about his voting records on violence against women to shut up in an incident caught on video. Barton was holding a town hall meeting in the city of Frost, the Dallas Morning News reported, when a constituent asked him if he would join with Democratic Congresswoman Jackie Speier to support a bill to protect women. Speier's bill would prohibit military service members from sharing intimate photos without the subject's permission. The bill is a response to the Marines United scandal, in which a private Facebook group of Marines was used to share nude photos of service women. Barton had voted against the previous bill, saying he felt it was a state, not federal issue. A man replied that violence against women is a national issue, and another said it's civil rights. When another man shouted, quote, "You represent Texas first," Barton said, "You, sir, shut up." Many in the crowd seemed bewildered, and a man can be heard saying, "What is this? You don't tell anybody to shut up. You work for us." This exchange is the latest in a series of contentious town hall meetings held by congressional Republicans.
Earlier this month, President Trump accused then-President Obama of wiretapping Trump Tower during the 2016 election. Trump made the claim in a series of tweets without offering any evidence. The House Intelligence Committee, which is investigating Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election, asked the White House to provide any evidence it has of Trump's allegations by the 20th of March. White House Counselor Kellyanne Conway offered a creative suggestion for how such surveillance could have been carried out. Conway suggested that television sets and microwaves could be turned into cameras. Conway may have been referring to WikiLeaks' recent release of documents that revealed CIA surveillance techniques, including hacking iPhones, computers, and TVs. On Sunday, Republican Senator John McCain from Arizona said he believes Trump, quote, has one of two choices, either retract or provide the information that the American people deserve.
Last Friday, Donald Trump demanded the resignation of 46 U.S. attorneys. Although it is not unusual for a new administration to replace appointees of the former president, they were controversially told that they had until the end of the day to clear out their offices. Just 2 days prior, Attorney General Jeff Sessions held a conference call with U.S. attorneys across the country and gave no indication that they may be asked to step down. U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Preet Bharara, refused to resign, and on Saturday he tweeted that he had been fired. Bharara is known for his hard line on prosecuting Wall Street and New York State government corruption. During the course of the transition, Mr. Trump had met with Bharara and asked him to stay on in his current position. On Thursday night, Sean Hannity from Fox News urged Trump to fire the attorneys, but the White House has denied any connection to the dismissals. Coincidentally, Bharara's office was leading federal investigation of Fox News for a number of potential crimes. The administration has yet to name any possible replacements for the attorneys who were asked to resign.
Donald Trump could sign an executive order this week which aims to reverse former President Barack Obama's Clean Power Plan, Bloomberg reported on Tuesday. The Clean Power Plan was Obama's signature environmental initiative. It required states to slash CO2 emissions, but was never implemented due to legal challenges from Republican states. Trump wants to scrap regulations limiting oil industry emissions of methane, a potent greenhouse gas. He's also calling for the elimination of the social cost of carbon, a measurement which weighs the potential economic damage from climate change. Environmentalists have long been appalled by Trump's agenda and his repeated denials that climate change is caused by human activity.
This week, South Dakota became the first state to allow religious adoption of family placement agencies to discriminate against prospective adoptive or foster parents based on the agency's religious guidelines. The bill has a direct impact on Native communities, where there is a history of separating youth from their cultural contexts, including through the use of boarding schools with assimilation programs. The Lakota tribe has experienced particularly high rates of this kind of involuntary separation. Jim Kent of FSRN reports from South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation.
The Pine Ridge Reservation is located along the border between South Dakota and Nebraska. It's home to members of the Oglala Sioux Tribe, also known as the Lakota. Despite largely successful efforts to maintain cultural traditions and a value system rooted in deep respect for women and children, the prevalence of domestic violence on the reservation is relatively high. Many Lakota attribute this to the lingering effects of the Christian and federal boarding school system that tore families apart for most of a century. As of July 2016, the Medicine Wheel Healing Community Organization reported 40 ongoing cases of child abuse on Pine Ridge, with more reports being investigated every day by the tribe's Child Protection Services Department. But when police officers responding to an assault complaint found two young malnourished and abused girls at a home in the reservation's Potato Creek community last November, Pine Ridge businesswoman Patty Puyer had had enough.
It just broke my heart, and I think it did a lot of other people, too. I couldn't get it off of my mind, and I decided enough is enough. I can make a difference. I'm not a social worker. I'm not an attorney, but I am an organizer. So I decided, you know what, I can try to organize a meeting to try to get a coalition of different entities together so we can maybe streamline help for children.
The Potato Creek girls, aged 2 and 3, were hidden under a pile of blankets on the floor and only weighed about 13 pounds each. A pediatrician who later examined the girls compared them to prisoners of World War II concentration camps. Puyer gathered community members and created a group called Embracing Our Children's Health. One of her first supporters was Donna Lamont, a supervisor for the Oglala Sioux Housing Authority on Pine Ridge. The home where the girls were found falls under the tribe's jurisdiction, where, like any government, the left hand often isn't aware of what the right hand is doing. Lamont says one key to prevention is to reinstate a practice the tribe's housing authority and public safety departments used to have.
Whatever they encountered out there, we went along with them and stuff, and we kind of lost that for a while. I don't know why, but we did.
Lamont says in addition to reestablishing that partnership, she hopes other tribal agencies on the reservation that deal with child welfare will communicate with Oglala Sioux Housing and with each other as well. But that's not all Embracing Our Children's Health is doing. The group left the gate at full speed. Members are establishing collective action forums to bring children's services on Pine Ridge together and determine how actions by one affect the work of another. They're also creating safe houses for children in each of the reservation's 9 districts, and a Caring for Relatives program is in the works, along with a volunteer network to support overwhelmed parents and provide the tribe's social and health services with much-needed human resources. In conjunction with the Oglala Sioux Tribe's Child Protection Services, the group is about to start intensive training for foster parents. While the Indian Child Welfare Act protects Native children from being permanently removed from the reservation and losing all identity within the culture, Puyer says there are other ways for non-Natives to provide for Native kids' needs.
It's also important for people to know that you can be a foster parent to a Native child as long as there is a community of Natives within the area that you're fostering that child.
To make sure children placed outside the reservation remain culturally connected, a Lakota spiritual chairman includes indigenous traditions in the group's programs. Though the primary focus is children between the ages of birth and 5 years, reviving coming-of-age ceremonies for boys and girls is also on the agenda. In the 19th century, all Native American ceremonies were banned, but were finally restored by the American Indian Religious Freedom Act in 1978. Patty Puyer says the ultimate goal is making children feel comfortable with who they are, to be free of shame and proud that they're Lakota. Oglala Sioux President Scott Weston began his term of office just 1 month after the girls were found at Potato Creek. He says child abuse is not just a tribal issue, but a state and national issue.
This should be initiated at the local level, but it should be carried out by the national level. So that means we start here, then we go to Washington to start this process back to improve what needs to happen, because currently it doesn't work.
Weston adds that the key to successful multi-agency efforts to protect Lakota children is ensuring the focus is on helping the children and not on political agendas. Jim Kent, FSRN, on the Pine Ridge Reservation.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for a special encore presentation of Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Preference at 6. Host Alan Silver discusses Sarah Schulman's new book, Conflict is Not Abuse. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Then at 8, The Melting Pot plays International Electronica. Tonight's weather is a low of 54 and a high of 57, with rain throughout the evening. Tomorrow's weather calls for a forecast of even more rain, with highs in the mid-50s and lows around 40. Today, we celebrate Pi Day, 314, celebrating the mathematical constant. And today's quote comes from Joe Lino's dad, who apparently has a pie joke that falls in the bad dad joke category. So, Joe, can you give us that pie joke?
Hey, kids. Did you hear scientists discovered that pi r squared is wrong? Pi r round. Cornbread r square.
Ugh.
Thanks to the high demand for sand in construction, engineering, and pharmaceuticals, two-thirds of beaches worldwide are dramatically receding. But now, you can have a beer to save a beach. The New Zealand-based company DB Breweries has constructed a machine that grinds empty beer bottles into pristine glass sand. The machines will most likely start appearing in bars and restaurants across New Zealand. To use the machine, patrons just place a finished beer bottle into it, and watch as their empty beer bottle becomes one cup of pure sand. Sean O'Donnell, marketing director at DB Breweries, said, quote, "Kiwis, we love our beaches and we love our beer. So wouldn't it be great if you could have a beer and do something for the environment? I mean, that's pretty exciting."
The European Union Court of Justice has ruled that private businesses are permitted to forbid Muslim women from wearing the hijab, a religious head covering. The ruling allows businesses to do so only if it's part of a policy of neutrality that bars all religious and political symbols and does not target a particular religion. The court said, quote, an internal rule of an undertaking which prohibits the visible wearing of any political, philosophical, or religious sign does not constitute direct discrimination, unquote. This is in response to two cases brought by women who were fired for refusing to remove their hijab, one in France and one in Belgium. Their respective countries' courts had asked for guidance from the EU Court of Justice, and these cases must still be resolved. The ruling has been hailed by the leaders of France's far-right political party, who have called for a widespread ban of religious symbols. Similar praise was heard from Germany's right-wing populist party, Alternative for Deutschland, as well as other right-wing leaders throughout the European Union.
On Sunday, a bus drove into a festival crowd in northern Haiti, killing 38 people and injuring at least 13 others. Local authorities are calling it a hit-and-run incident. People were in the street celebrating Rara, which is a festive season in Haiti beginning between Ash Wednesday and Easter Sunday. The bus first struck two pedestrians just outside the city of Gonaives, killing one. It then went on several miles before encountering a Rara band playing music in the middle of the road. The bus plowed through the band, then through a second and third group of musicians. The driver fled on foot and has not been found by police.
A 700-year-old lair of the Knights Templar has been found near Shropshire, England. The network of tunnels is located less than 3 feet below a farmer's field and accessed through what looks like a rabbit hole. The Knights Templar were a medieval Christian order who took vows of poverty during the Crusades. They became one of the most powerful orders of the time, who some believe were the keepers of the legendary Holy Grail. The lair itself is a network of tunnels filled with elaborately carved arches leading to caverns where it is believed the knights held secret rituals. The lair, however, has not been a secret to many youths in the area and has been the site of local drinking parties. Modern-day druids and people practicing black magic have also been using the lair for quite some time. The owner of the land had tried to block access to the tunnels, but each time he has barred the entrance, the barriers have been ripped out within days. Predictably, greater problems occur during the solstices and Halloween.
Poland will seek the arrest and extradition of Michael Karkok, a Minnesota resident, after confirming that he commanded a Nazi SS unit during World War II. Karkok is suspected of ordering the killings of 44 Polish residents. The decision in Poland comes 4 years after the Associated Press published a story establishing that Karkok commanded the unit. The Associated Press based its story on wartime documents, testimony from other members of the unit, and Karkok's own Ukrainian language memoir. Karkok's family says he suffers from Alzheimer's disease. Prosecutors in Germany shelved their investigation of Karkok in 2015 after receiving documentation from the geriatric hospital in the U.S. where he was being treated and concluded he was not fit for trial. If convicted of the murder charges, Karkok, now 98 years old, could face life in prison. Efren Zuroff, the head Nazi hunter at the Simon Wiesenthal Center, applauded the decision as an important signal even at this late stage.
Here's another example of how electronic devices can track users, and this one is up close and personal. An Illinois federal court found that Canadian manufacturer WeVibe sold, quote, smart vibrators, end quote, to wary buyers, then collected data from the devices without customers' knowledge. The WeVibe 4 Plus is a Bluetooth-connected vibrator which can be controlled through an app. But the app came with security and privacy vulnerabilities which were revealed at the DEF CON hacking conference in Las Vegas. Anyone within Bluetooth range could take control of the device and collect intimate information about temperature and intensity of use. WeVibe's parent company, Standard Innovation, has agreed to pay customers up to $7,400 each and a total settlement of $3.9 million.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Audrey Ashright, Al Kahn, Miriam Widman, and Tom Flynn. The producer is Joe Lino. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and Workers Independent News Labor Radio. Our engineer is Tom Flint. The KBOO Evening News Director is Zelos Marchant, and the Evening Public Affairs Director is Kanan Schlesinger. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Joe Lino.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 a.m. on Wednesday Talk Radio, Paul Roland talks to Theo Anderson about his new In These Times cover story on the right-wing machine behind Trump. At 9, Political Perspectives updates you on ongoing exchange between PSU students and kids at the McLaren Youth Correctional Facility. At 10 a.m., Chris Andre hosts Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. Then at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's The Food Show for people who love to eat. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Have a good night, Joe.
Have a good night, Jen.
Night, Wesley.
Good night.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the House Republicans have unveiled their long-promised replacement to what they presented for many months as the unmitigated disaster of the Affordable Care Act. Now, the Washington Post says, the most serious threat to the passage of this GOP bill is that conservative Republicans don't like it. How well does that framing set us up to talk about other people's concerns, like what these Trump-backed changes could mean for the millions of people with disabilities and senior citizens who rely on Medicare and Medicaid, Social Security programs that are relatively starved for media attention as it is? We'll talk about press coverage of Trump Care with Nancy Altman. She's co-director of the group Social Security Works and author of the book The Battle for Social Security, From FDR's Vision to Bush's Gamble. Also on the show, the Supreme Court recently announced that it won't hear the case of Gavin Grimm, the transgender boy seeking the right to use the boys' bathroom in his high school, and it will kick it back to a lower court. That might sound like a non-event, but the Supreme Court's refusal to offer a full-throated defense of transgender rights right now serves as yet another signal that transgender people, already extremely vulnerable, can count on still less protection from state institutions. And that signal is having an impact. We'll talk about the court decision and about resistance to the message it sends with Chris Hayashi, Executive Director of the Transgender Law Center. All of that is coming up, but first we'll take a look back at recent press. A welcome return. That's the Guardian newspaper's sincere description of George W. Bush's mild criticisms of Donald Trump on NBC's Today Show. As Owen Higgins noted on Fair.org, Bush extolled the virtues of the news media, indispensable to democracy, he says, waxed philosophical on the contributions of immigrants, and decried Trump's Muslim ban as antithetical to America's tolerance of other faiths, which Bush called a bedrock of our freedom. Well, Bush took that show on tour. He appeared on The Ellen Show and posed for pictures on the host's Instagram account. Then he swung by Jimmy Kimmel for a friendly discussion about his new book of paintings, paintings of 100 or so of the U.S. veterans that he sent to war. "I was thinking of their stories, their troubles, their joys," Bush shared with People magazine. The Guardian editorial said, quote, "It says a lot about the United States that Mr. Bush can be seen now as a paragon of virtue," close quote. But it really only says a lot about U.S. corporate media. As Higgins notes, news media have been massaging the images of Oval Office alumni for decades, with this post-presidential rehabilitation mainly used to try and push the current president to adopt some policy or priority. George W. Bush himself left office as the disgraced son of a dynasty, with his own father presented, relatively, as a respected elder statesman. The wreck he made of Iraq and the disasters left behind after his unilateral invasions of Panama and Somalia, forgiven and mostly forgotten. The same historical amnesia is at work now in elite media's group hug for George W. Bush, such that a person who called for a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage can now laugh with Ellen DeGeneres and stump for a book of paintings of veterans he himself put in harm's way. The book is called Portraits of Courage, a Commander-in-Chief's Tribute to America's Warriors. As Vijay Prashad notes on Alternet, there are no paintings of Iraqis, civilians or soldiers. And, quote, "not one of the profiles in Courage includes the Iraqis who collaborated with the U.S. occupation and now find themselves unable to enter the United States as a consequence of Trump's Muslim ban," close quote. Prashad cites a moment on the Today Show when Bush said to Matt Lauer, quote, "we need an independent media to hold people like me to account," close quote. Well, watching the guy who launched an illegal war responsible for the deaths of at least a half million people, who codified torture into U.S. law, who abated the unnatural disaster of Hurricane Katrina and the biggest economic crisis since the Great Depression, cheered like a favorite uncle, I'd have to say we couldn't say it better ourselves. And finally, March 8th marked an international women's strike, a coordinated day of action, not limited to work stoppage, that organizers said was intended to highlight how women's work, contributions, and humanity continue to be undervalued. With an avowed misogynist in the White House, the day got more media attention than it usually does. We saw stories about events around the world and interviews with participants. Some women-focused websites offered no new content as a show of support. We're told MTV's female staffers stayed out, and the network turned its logo upside down, making the M a W. And the Washington Times reports women anchors on MSNBC and CNN showed their leftist leanings by wearing red. Well, what we didn't see was media taking the day as a chance for serious self-reflection or conversation about how their portrayals of women and the absences contribute to that continued discrimination. The most recent data from the Women's Media Center tell us that men write 62% of the stories in the top 10 newspapers. Men write 58% of the content at four top online news sites, 62% of wire stories, and in the nightly broadcast news, men are on camera 68% of the time. In a piece for The Nation, strike organizers Tithi Bhattacharya and Cinzia Arruza stressed that the New York City rally would feature no celebrities, instead foregrounding the women you don't usually see in the media. Well, if media keep missing opportunities to look in the mirror, that won't be any less necessary next March 8th. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. $5.1 Far from seamless was how the Washington Post described the debut of House Republicans' much vaunted, by them, replacement for the Affordable Care Act. Like others, this story was about how right-wing Republicans might present hurdles to the plan's passage because it's too much like the dreaded Obamacare, and how they might be appeased. So much coverage of health care is set in terms of the political process, who presents obstacles, what groups are being whistled to, that the specifics, the reality of how changes in policy could affect actual people, can sometimes get lost. And health care could hardly be a worse place for that to happen. Here to help us see some of what's going on with this GOP bill is Nancy Altman. She's co-director of Social Security Works and co-chair of the Strengthen Social Security Coalition and Campaign. She joins us now by phone from Maryland. Welcome back to Counterspin, Nancy Altman.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it seems that in the media, Medicare and Medicaid are mostly mentioned as a kind of in one breath tag on to Social Security, you know, when a story is giving a thumbnail of so-called entitlements. These programs are rarely center stage. I wonder if you could tell us about how this Republican plan, from what we know of it, would affect Medicare and Medicaid, and along the way, remind us of what those programs do.
The so-called Trump Care, this new health care plan that the Republicans have just rolled out, is very destructive to both Medicare and Medicaid. The Republicans ran against the Affordable Care Act, the so-called Obamacare, but no one ran against Medicare and Medicaid because the programs work very well and they're very popular. Medicare is, both programs were enacted in 1965. The idea behind Medicare is that it's a part of Social Security, that you cannot really be economically secure if you're one illness away from bankruptcy. So Medicare provides basic health insurance for those 65 and over who are receiving Social Security. Medicaid is intended as a low-income program, but it is the only part of our healthcare system that provides basic insurance for long-term care. So actually, many seniors, many middle-class seniors who find themselves in need of long-term nursing home care wind up relying on Medicaid. So they are both programs that cover much of the Social Security beneficiary population. All three programs work very well. They're very popular. And I should say one more thing, that the Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, and other Republicans have been gunning for all these programs for decades.
Right.
And now I think they see they have their chance. So what this does is it basically destroys Medicaid. That was expanded under the Affordable Care Act. That expansion is going to be gone. But in addition, they're going to, instead of now having, if you've got that insurance and you need a medical procedure and it gets paid for, instead they're going to do a kind of cousin of block granting where they're going to give the states money and just say, okay, you take care of your own population. States often are strapped. It will be very hard to keep that coverage. And for Medicare, they literally raid Medicare. They take about several hundred billion dollars out of Medicare, and what they do is give very large tax breaks for the very wealthy.
Well, let me just add that Medicaid, of course, listeners should know, besides with seniors, of course, it's also a main source of funding for a wide variety of disability services as well. People with disabilities, including older people who need attendance, or even, you know, Ari Neiman wrote a piece on Talk Poverty talking about, you know, the 24-year-old with Down syndrome who gets a job coach, the 6-year-old with a disability whose parents need support. Medicaid is also critical to people with disabilities and providing them more independence and freedom. That's true.
That's exactly right. And to millions of children in this nation, too, who are low income.
Right, right.
So it is. And Medicare also provides basic insurance for people with disabilities. So it's seniors, which is why the AARP has come out against this bill. But as you point out, it's millions and millions of other Americans.
Right. Well, the Washington Post, that piece had a source from Heritage who was talking about how this GOP plan isn't good enough because it doesn't create
a free market healthcare system. So, you know, that's one of the points on the continuum of conversation, is a system where poor people just die, you know, because I don't know what else that means. Now, some people maybe are ideologically okay with that, but for a lot of people, I think it fits with their understanding that we're just in a situation of scarcity. We can't afford a system that the government administers. That's, if you would say, the big lie.
That is the big lie. We are the wealthiest nation in the world, and we are the at the wealthiest moment in our history. We're wealthier than we were in 1935 when Social Security was enacted. We're wealthier now than we were in 1965 when Medicare and Medicaid were enacted. And you are exactly right. The long-range plan for Medicare is to what they call voucherize it, which is basically to turn the clock back before 1965. Before 1965, millions of seniors could not get health insurance at any price because they had pre-existing conditions. They were just seen as too expensive. And those that could had to pay huge markup for health insurance. And that's why we wound up getting Medicare. They want to turn this back to the private sector and let people just go out and give them some premium support to go out and buy some premiums and to buy insurance and help a little pay for premiums, when that is just the wrong way to go.
Well, I guess we have to push back then with like a big truth or a bigger vision. And I have seen some people saying, well, the fact that this plan is creating these kind of fissures, even among Republicans for whatever reasons, but, you know, that they think maybe that's opening space to talk about single payer.
Medicare for all. Medicare was intended as a first step. In fact, there was a debate whether you first covered all children because it's much less expensive and they have a lifetime of health, or seniors, where, as I said, the need was dire. But they saw it as simply the first step. Even though Medicare covers the most expensive part of our population, seniors and people with disabilities, it is much more efficient than private sector insurance because it is universal for all people over age 65. Other countries can provide all of their citizens with complete affordable access to health care, and they have better health outcomes, and they spend less than we do. If we expanded Medicare for all and started by simply lowering the age to 62, putting in a MediKids program, we would have a much more efficient program, and maybe that's where we're going, because that is a system that works.
Right. And, you know, just in terms of how we talk about it, it seems